Okay, we're on for the final argument of the morning session, Gentles v. Borough of Pottstown, appellate number 22-2925.
May it please the court, Becca Steinberg for appellant Sukima Gentles. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
This case stems from an anonymous phone call that a black man was looking in garage windows. Nothing indicated that the call was reliable. And the call seemed to relate only to garages, so when the caller said the person had left and Portak confirmed the alley was empty, there shouldn't have been any reason to worry. But instead, when Portak came across Gentles a mile away with his 3 and 4-year-old kids in the backseat of his car, Portak initiated a seizure, handcuffed Gentles, locked him in the back of a police car for 20 minutes, and then brought unsuccessful charges for disorderly conduct.
How much do we know, and how do we know it, about the information that was actually conveyed to Officer Portak? Because my understanding is that apparently no recordation of this report that was made was available during the litigation. And so there's no way that we can truly accurately determine the actual words that were spoken by the occupant of apparently a nearby dwelling to the city or the city police department.
Correct, and that goes to the reliability of the call. To answer your question, it seems that there are only two pieces of information that are in the record about what the call contained. The first was that a black man was looking in garage windows, mm-hmm. and the second was the license plate number on the vehicle.
And the source of that is the police report that memorializes what was relayed to that officer.
Yes, Your Honor. And the license plate doesn't contribute to reliability at all, as the Supreme Court made clear in JL.
Reliability of what?
So the reliability has to go to criminality specifically. And well, that's
understood, but there's no issue about reliability of the license being the license that was seen by the citizen who reported it.
Correct. There's no issue there. Just like in JL, there was no issue that the caller correctly identified that JL was wearing a plaid shirt, but that didn't make the allegations of criminal conduct more reliable.
You recounted a sequence of events and you focused on Officer Portak?
Yes,
conduct. What is the evidence concerning Officer UNRRA? I know there's a representation by Officer Portak that UNRRA wasn't there. There seems to be a dispute about that. Mr. Gentles says he was there. I'm ignoring the videotape for the time being since that's not in the summary judgment record.
Yes.
So what's the evidence that Officer UNRRA played any role in the alleged Fourth Amendment violation?
So I would distinguish the initial seizure from the scope, and we're not alleging that UNRRA was involved with the initial seizure at all, but he was involved in the handcuffing.
I'm sorry to interrupt. The initial seizure being
of the terrace.
Calling out to Mr. Gentles to stop or to requiring that he provide his identification or his name?
Telling him that he's not free to leave.
So the most the record shows is that UNRRA comes into the picture a little bit later.
Yes, and he's involved in the handcuffing. The video shows that. Judge Schwartz, I understand that you want to put the video to the side, but there's still a dispute of fact because you have testimony on the one hand from Portak saying he wasn't there. You have testimony from Mr. Gentles on the other hand saying I saw him there. That's a dispute of fact because you have conflicting testimony about what these two individuals witnessed in that circumstance.
We have two buckets of alleged wrongs, I guess, from your point of view. One is whether the seizure was supported by reasonable suspicion. And the second was whether the scope and duration of that seizure was appropriate. If we think there are disputed facts about whether the stop had reasonable suspicion, do we need to address the seizure point, the duration and scope point?
Not with regards to Portak, but yes, with regards to UNRRA. And so also,
how would you propose we address that? Where are the issues of fact there?
So the issues of fact, quite frankly, I think that Mr. Gentles, if he had moved for summary judgment, might have been entitled to it. But what courts have considered are duration, intrusive methods, whether officers were acting diligently, and the safety concerns. At no point has anyone articulated that there were any safety concerns at issue that might warrant a handcuffing or locking Mr. Gentles in the police car. There were intrusive methods, so handcuffing and being locked in what's equivalent to a traveling jail cell. And it lasted for 20 minutes, which is longer than the Supreme Court held in Florida v. Royer.
Now, that includes the period of time he was also in the police car. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And then, so to the extent, Judge Schwartz, that there is a dispute of fact, it's whether the officers were acting diligently. They've never at any stage explained what they were doing for the entire 20 minutes or why they needed 20 minutes for Mr. Gentles to be locked and handcuffed. They've offered two supposed justifications. The first is that they needed him to identify himself. Well, they had his identification. They had taken his wallet with his ID in it before he was locked in the back of the police car. And the second thing that they said is that they wanted him to calm down. But wanting someone to be less upset doesn't justify handcuffing them and locking them in the back of the police car. So first of all, he was only outside of his own car for a matter of seconds, as the video shows. But second of all is that he was reasonably justified by the unlawful search that had happened.
What should Officer Portok, what should he have done under these circumstances? The briefing, various memos I've read have continuously referred to what was imparted by a citizen as a tip, and it's not what I would consider traditionally to be a tip, because none of the information that we've been provided, first of all, suggests either that a crime was in the course of being committed or attempted. I would more accurately view it as maybe a citizen complaint, at least a citizen report,
yes,
if you will. And again, the lack of any kind of recording deprives us of all sorts of information that should have existed and that may have existed. But what should the officer have done, having had that citizen information reported to him? I'm hearing from you certainly what he should not have done, but you're not suggesting that he should not have acted upon it at all, are you?
No, not at all. So he was perfectly entitled to, quite frankly, a fair bit of what he did. That is, he went to the alley, he went, checked out, he cleared the call, suggesting that there wasn't any reason to be concerned anymore. And what he said is he returned to his routine patrol. Mm-hmm. So he went, he checked it out. That's something he could have done. He could have also engaged in a voluntary conversation with Mr. Gentles.
Well, before we get to that, it seems to be happenstance then that he does come upon the vehicle which bears the license plate number that he'd been provided, right?
Correct. He said he's back to his routine patrol. It's not like he's looking for that vehicle. He just stumbles upon it.
And so he at some point asks for information, asks for identification, or ask what the name was. I'm forgetting right now. Did he ask for a form of identification, or did he ask to tell me your name?
He asked for a form of identification. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's after the seizure has already been commenced, as I think we make clear in Section 1 of our brief. So everyone agrees that the seizure happened when...
Right. Again, just to be explicit about it, the seizure being actually telling... Mr. Gentles to do what?
That he was not free to leave.
Got it.
And that happened per Portok's report at JA44.
Right.
That happened before Officer Portok demanded that Mr. Gentles turn over
Understood.
His ID.
So is it your position that the explanation that we learn about in Mr. Gentles' deposition, that is, he really didn't want to deal with the police, does that play a role in the reasonable suspicion calculation?
No, because it's based off of what the officer knows at the time, and the officer certainly didn't know that at the time. There's no allegation that he did.
We can just go to this malicious prosecution claim.
Absolutely.
What evidence do you have that Mr. Unruh played any role in initiating a prosecution here?
We're only pursuing the malicious prosecution claim with regard to Officer Portok. And I think it's
only pursuing as to Officer Portock.
Only as to Officer Portock. And I think it's quite clear that there are two pretty straightforward ways that the court could rule for us. The first is that what Officer Portock needed to initiate these criminal charges was probable cause of criminal activity. This disorderly conduct by unreasonable noise statute has two elements, an actus reus element and a mens rea element. The defendants have never offered any argument whatsoever, so effectively conceded the mens rea prong. At the point that the mens rea isn't met, there's no criminal activity, and at the point that they didn't have probable cause of the mens rea, they didn't have probable cause of criminal activity.
Mens rea, what? Mens rea, what's the mens rea here?
The intent or reckless disregard for causing the neighborhood to be concerned.
Don't you have something simpler here? Isn't there a dispute about how loud it was?
Yes, so that's why I said that there are two pretty straightforward ways that the court could rule in Mr. Gentles' favor on this prong, the mens rea being one because it was entirely conceded, so I think little analysis would be needed. But the second is on the actus reus prong, so, you know, quite frankly, the video shows he wasn't being loud. And that makes sense.
It's
given
in the video, it's on summary judgment land.
Yes, so he stated there's a dispute of fact then based on Mr. Gentles' own testimony about how loud he was. And that makes sense given the time of day. That makes sense given what's happening. So times where this disorderly conduct by unreasonable noise statute has been applied include cases like the AE Pi case, where there is a frat party blasting loud music in the middle of the night, or McNeil, where there's someone's being loud and screaming between 2 and 3:30 in the morning, surrounded by a bunch of senior citizens, or Vessel, where someone's kicked out of a bar at 2 a.m. and so starts screaming and banging on the doors.
I assume you're relying on, for this disputed fact about volume, Gentle's deposition.
Yes,
and
Your Honor.
Officer Portek's description in his report. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in the record, we have the statements of undisputed fact. And
yes.
We have a response by Mr. Gentles where he, quote, denied, I'm going to use the ing, is screaming and raising his voice to the extent it can be considered a public nuisance. How is that evidential if it's just a response to a statement of undisputed fact? Or do we not need to consider it because we have these other sources I've just mentioned?
So because of the other sources, first of all, but second of all, it's saying that there's the absence of a fact. So to the extent that Portock said there is a fact and that he was being loud and Mr. Gentle said there's the absence of that fact, that is a dispute as to whether that fact is true. So I think that the case that's most analogous on the malicious prosecution is Gilbert, where a neighbor disagreed with the police's decision to tow his neighbor's car, so he was yelling across the street. That's certainly a much greater distance than what was at issue here. This was in the middle of the day, and they've offered no sort of argument or suggestion that the neighbors looking on was caused in any way by Mr. Gentles. In fact, a jury could reasonably find that it was caused by the large police presence in the area. If there are further questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, I'd like to reserve.
No, thank you. We'll see you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Andrew Rangas on behalf of the Pottstown defendants. In regard to this case, in looking at the facts and the circumstances, picking up on some of the points that Your Honors and the court have made in regard to Officer Portock's initial response, in taking a look at the appellant's argument and playing it out to its logical conclusion, their position would be that there is no response that Officer Portock could have made in this situation once the alleyway was cleared of the vehicle and the individual not being there. But as the court is well aware, the standard for the reasonable suspicion is the totality of the circumstances. And when taking into consideration the totality of the circumstances, in this case, the court should look at the fact that where, although it's a mile away, it's 7/10 of a mile away, it's a 3-minute drive from the area, it's in close proximity from where the alleyway and the initial call from, again, presumably an individual who observed the what is reported from the police report, and I agree with the court that there is scarce information when it comes to what is made known to the officer, but we do know specifically that the two bits of information that were made known was there was a black male who was looking in windows of garages in that alleyway.
Excuse me, are these, were we dealing with here a 911 call?
That would be the, yes, Your Honor, it would
so
be.
There ought to be in place ordinarily a recording system.
There would be, yes, Your Honor.
Is there something in the record that says this is a 911 call?
There is not, Your Honor. However, that would be the way that the call would be made for emergency calls into Pottstown Borough.
I asked it only because every 911 call, every 911 call I've ever known was recorded. So I would assume
I agree, Your Honor, and I
happens in Pottstown.
And I can't, I don't know why that information was not put into the record in this case. Unfortunately, I was not counsel of record that handled the case at the district court or through the briefing of this matter. However, we are stuck with the record, so to speak, as we have it. The other piece of information that we know is that a subsequent call is made, or at least subsequent information is relayed to the officer saying that the vehicle is leaving the area. When the officer arrives in the area, the vehicle is gone and the call is cleared. Approximately 10 minutes later, in close proximity, so to speak, the officer finds the vehicle with the matching license plate, and based upon the record from the lower district court level, the individual is in close proximity to the vehicle. The officer stops, goes out to speak to the vehicle operator, the black male, and one of the parts that I believe is not mentioned by the appellants is that as the officer is approaching, Mr. Gentles begins to walk away.
I don't think there's that. I think that's in the record.
No,
he begins to walk away.
Correct. But at that point, the officer then says, hey, 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 meaning wants to talk to him. And Mr. Gentles then gets into the car and starts the vehicle, at which point the officer comes up and the interactions with him begin.
So are you now abandoning the assertion that I understood Mr. Portock to say, which was Mr. Gentles rushed to the car?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that when we're taking the totality of the circumstances, that piece of information from my reading of the briefs was left out of the appellants when they make their argument, in the sense of that the officer, in speaking about the rush.
My understanding of the record, we have the deposition, we have a police report, and we have the affidavit of Mr. Gentles, is that Officer Portock directed his comment to Mr. Gentles. Mr. Gentles decided to proceed to his car.
Correct. And that's where we come into that rushed, that rushed commentary. And the issue is to whether or not Mr. Gentles' affidavit of I walked at a regular normal gait as opposed to Officer Portock's view that it was rushed or hurried somehow is
A material disputed fact,
yes.
And isn't it a material disputed fact in the circumstances where the nature of the information, the tip, so to speak, it's indicia of reliability, not that the person was making it up, but the indicia of reliability don't necessarily satisfy the factors, and such that you needed something else to justify the stop.
No, I agree, Your Honor, and I do. I believe that it is, and I believe that it is necessary, but I don't
but we have a dispute of fact as to whether he rushed or he walked at a normal gait.
My point being, Your Honor, is I think that it's important because of the fact it's important from the officer's perspective as to what happened. Perhaps Mr. Gentles did walk at a normal, at his normal, regular, steady gait and normal walk. But to Officer Portock, from his experience and understanding, it appeared to be hurried or rushed.
But don't we have to let a jury decide that?
How is that material then if it's...
Because isn't it corroborative of whether or not he had reason to suspect criminality on the part of Mr. Gentles?
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor. I think that it depends upon whether In order for it to be material for a jury to decide, it means that the jury then needs to make a credibility determination as to whether or not it believes Officer Portock's
perspective
as opposed to Mr. Gentle's perspective. But in this case, it has nothing to measure that credibility determination on other than just the mere fact of the normal, regular credibility determinations that a jury would make. And my point being, and it kind of goes to whether or not that self-serving affidavit that the court asked us to discuss comes into play, is if that was the case, then there would never be an instance where a material fact would not come into play and where self-serving affidavits would not be permitted. Because there would always be a material fact in which someone could have their personal belief and opinion, where there would be a credibility determination that would need to be made.
I don't think that the description of the affidavit was an opinion. The person offered their account, factual account of how they perceived their behavior. And Mr. Portock, for his point, articulated how he observed the behavior.
Correct. And in the examples...
And it informed, and I think the reason why that's important is it informed Officer Portock's decision to continue to pursue Mr. Gentles to try to get his attention.
Correct. And it also formed the basis then as to, under the totality of the circumstances, as to make that determination as to whether or not there was some type of that extra something in order to make the decision to detain in order to maintain the status quo and do further investigation as to whether or not criminal activity was afoot based upon a Terry stop.
I just want to break down a little bit what the points that you're making about the normal gait and Officer Portock's perception of the gait. So at least in theory, if there were a trial, the district judge might permit Mr. Gentles to demonstrate what his normal gait is, right? And then the jury could weigh its observation of that demonstration against testimony from Officer Portock that he perceived Gentles to be rushing. And perhaps Officer Portock would watch the demonstration and say, well, that's not actually what it was. So are you with me so far that these are potential things that could happen at
a trial?
I am with
you, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if in this hypothetical, Mr. Gentles were to demonstrate his normal gait and Officer Portock said, yeah, that's what he did. And to me, that's rushing. Then, so where do we go with that in terms of your argument that this is not appropriate? This is not a material dispute of fact.
My point to that, Your Honor, is in looking at that there was other evidence available that could have been utilized by Mr. Gentles in order to dispute that fact. And in the cases that are cited in the instances in which these self-serving affidavits have been found to be utilized, for example, the case where they talk about whether or not in the prison system the prisoner went forward and had done all of the necessary administrative steps to exhaust. The evidence was that from the prison was, well, hey, we never received any of the exhaustion or any of the appeals that were necessary. And the prisoner says, no, I filed them. I did. And the court in that case determined and said, well, hey, appeals get lost. Things happen. There is a question of fact there where there nothing else can be shown in order to say whether or not this can be proven one way or the other. So there really is a material question of fact. Here there were other opportunities possibly available to Mr. Gentles in order to be able to show whether or not there was this, as silly as it may sound, hurried walk back to the
deposed.
Police.
He was deposed. There was plenty of opportunity for for the counsel for Poston and the officers to ask him questions. He was offering an affidavit to adduce an additional fact. So there was an opportunity. Just because it helps his position doesn't mean it's not admissible for the purposes of the summary judgment decision.
But, Your Honor, I understand that. I'm saying that Mr. Gentles could have put forth evidence to support his self-serving affidavit.
What more was he supposed to put forth other than his own description of his own conduct?
He certainly could have put forth an affidavit from the individual whom he was speaking to.
Why does he need to do that? Why is it necessary? Why does he need corroboration?
He needs...
He had no one else. Let's pretend there was nobody else on the street and there was nobody else in the car. It was just him and the officer. That's it.
And then in that situation, then perhaps maybe this would be that self-serving situation. But, Your Honor, taking
that
your...
That would be self-serving?
No, that would be a situation where a affidavit would be the only means in which it could be possible.
So the test you'd like us to lay down is you can offer your own affidavit in support of a description of your own conduct so long as there's nobody else that could attest to it. If there are others who can attest to it, then we can only admit that affidavit if we have corroboration.
Your Honor, my only point on that is that under these circumstances, then, what is the scenario in which a district court can grant summary judgment if the only evidence that is provided is a affidavit from the party saying that they contest the various facts that are brought forward? If that's the only evidence that's presented in the district court record, as it is in this case, then there can never be an instance in which a district court can grant summary judgment.
So I think I hear you saying the district court shouldn't be bound by an affidavit that just says, I disagree. But he did a little bit more than just say, I disagree with that, with the fact that the defendant has put on. He said he proffered affirmative evidence of his normal gait. Right. So are you saying that really, in essence, he's just saying, I disagree with the defendant's fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's exactly what it is. Only because if you look at the record in the affidavit, conclusion is that I walked to the car in my normal gait, in my steady normal gait. That's conclusory at best. And as to whether or not it's material, again, it's material as to whether or not it disputes the officer's interpretation as to whether or not it was hurried. But again, it is self-serving because there's no other evidence to dispute that or to support that.
Do you agree that the focus should be on the information available up until the time the stop happened? For the purposes of reasonable suspicion.
Yes, Your Honor.
As a result, did the district court err in relying on the purported refusal to provide identification as part of its Terry stop analysis? Would that be error?
I think it depends upon when the district court made the determination as to when the seizure occurred. And the reason that I point that out to is because, as was discussed in the briefs, it depends upon when Mr. Gentles submitted to the seizure.
When the officer, doesn't the record reviewing the facts in a light most favorable occur when he acceded to the authority pronounced by Officer Portok, don't go?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's when the seizure happened.
That's when the seizure happened,
yes. So then it would be inappropriate under that scenario to consider anything that happened after that for the purposes of examining the Terry stop.
Yes, but again, without the benefit of the video, as Your Honor has indicated, and we agree that the video is not in evidence in the district court.
On the summary judgment record.
Correct. Without that, in looking at the record at that point, there is a question as to where there is definitely evidence which shows there's no dispute, of the fact that Mr. Gentles refuses to give and is uncooperative, refuses to give his...
That's irrelevant for the point.
I agree.
Right?
I understand. But the question becomes is when he comes up and says to him, in the report it specifically says that he was told he was free, he was not free to leave at that point, as being the first point in the report. It then goes into what the interactions with him were. In the district court opinion, the district court's opinion doesn't specifically go with that specific timeline, is the point that I'm making out to you. So my point being is that the district court, it's not necessarily clear as with that definitive line as to where the court determines when the seizure takes place. It may have been, based upon the reading of the district court's opinion, it might have been a few moments later after there was at least one of the requests for the ID and it's refused, meaning, I'm sorry, not for the ID, where the statement is made, you are, this is a criminal investigation, at which point Mr. Gentles becomes belligerent and says, there is no criminal investigation, there can't be a criminal investigation at that point. I realize that may not be clear, but in looking at the district court's opinion, I think you'll notice.
The decision of when a seizure occurs is a de novo legal conclusion, correct?
Agreed, yes. But I do think that the court should certainly give at least deference and review to Judge Jones's decision, especially given the fact that in this case, and again, I recognize it's a de novo decision, that the fact that there's a Terry stop may have been, based upon Judge Jones's opinion, may have been agreed to by Mr. Gentles in the district court filings. Stop. He concedes it, right?
He has ceded to it. He didn't move. I'd like to just ask you very quickly just on the malicious prosecution claim. There seems to be another disputed fact, and it has to do with the volume of Mr. Gentles' voice, because we have to focus on that since that's the disorderly conduct provision relied upon by Officer Porduck to charge him. How do you get around that? He says he wasn't loud, and any people were already outside, and any additional people came because of the police response, not his voice and the volume, I should say.
I do, Your Honor. I do have a way around that.
I'll hear you.
The cases cited specifically Gilbert and Merez, as I'm sure that the court has reviewed, the standard that is being implied in those cases is a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. And the when going through the analysis that's provided to is, again, for that beyond a reasonable doubt. We're only at the probable cause standard.
I'm with you. But if there's, you have to have probable cause to believe, for the purposes of this citation, that the individual engaged in disorderly conduct by raising their voice, by being unreasonably loud.
Correct.
There seems to be a dispute about whether the loudness was unreasonable and perhaps whether there was loudness at all.
I don't know that there was loudness. Again, we get into that whole, and this again brings back to my whole argument before of that self-serving argument, or that self-serving affidavit of, again, this is a prime example of...
What if there were no depositions taken? What if the borough said, we're not going to take a deposition, and all we're going to do is, you know, we're going to make a motion for summary judgment, and Mr. Gentles agrees he's going to give an affidavit. Exactly the same affidavit. So all we have is the affidavit and the police report. Is it a self-serving affidavit that we can't consider using your language, self-serving?
Well, it's not my language, Your Honor. It's the district court's language that was used.
Consider that affidavit or not under that scenario.
I think depending upon the basis of the record that is supplied with the police reports and the other information that's there, and depending upon whether or not...
So your point of view would be if we have a police report, an individual could not offer an affidavit to rebut with specificity, as Judge Freeman was saying, not just a blanket denial, but actual specificity. From your point of view, that could not be sufficient evidence to survive summary judgment.
Under certain scenarios, Your Honor, yes, I think that it could be. I don't know that based upon this district court's record that it would be under these scenarios.
Understood. Okay. Judge Smith, anything further? Judge Freeman? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Counsel.
Two points, Your Honor. The first, Judge Smith, is to respond to your question about the phone call. Just now we heard that it was a 911 call. Nothing in the record supports that. The only information in the record is at JA 44 that they received information from an anonymous call. We pointed this out at pages 18 to 19 of our opening brief, and it was not disputed in the response brief. There's nothing in the record suggesting that the call was made to 911. As you know, you mentioned in your question, the reason that matters is because there's no recording here, and the lack of recording goes to the lack of reliability. The second point, and last point that I want to make in my rebuttal, is fundamentally what we just heard is that there's a dispute of fact. That's why this case should go to a jury. There's a dispute of fact, Judge Schwartz, to the question you asked about when he walked to his car. JA 44, Officer Portok's own words said, at that point, which was before he asked for his ID, he told him he was not free to leave. And so there's a dispute of fact as to the sequence of those events. Judge Freeman, there's also a dispute of fact about the question that you asked, which was the pace at which Mr. Gentles walked to his car. Officer Portock said he rushed. Mr. Gentles said he walked at his normal pace. To the extent that opposing counsel says that Mr. Gentles' affidavit is not properly relied on, that's incorrect for a few reasons. First, I would point to Lupien and Palladino, the cases we cite at page 22 of our brief, saying that, yes, of course, affidavits are self-serving. What matters is whether they're conclusory. And as Judge Freeman, your question got at, here it's not conclusory because it states specific facts about the pace at which he was walking. But second of all, as I would point to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56, which specifically points to affidavit as a key means of establishing evidence. It's just not the case that an affidavit can't be relied on in this context. But then third, about the pace at which he rushed his car, is even putting that dispute aside, Mr. Gentles is perfectly entitled as an ordinary citizen to leave and not talk to the police. That's what differentiates a consensual encounter from a Terry stop. And his refusal, his desire not to talk to the police, is something that he has the right to do and something that the officers couldn't use in this circumstance to justify the seizure.
One question for you about the alleged 911 call. So when we talk about a tip's reliability, we consider whether it was conveyed over the phone or in person and whether the tipster is known or unknown and other factors. But why does it matter if it was a 911 call or some other method of conveying a phone tip?
So this is what the Supreme Court talked about in Navarrete. Again, we talk about this at pages 18 and 19 of our brief. But because often there's some means of getting follow-up information when there's a 911 call and that you don't have in a situation like this necessarily.
But so if for instance, the caller dialed the precinct directly or somehow had, you know, the officer's phone number, a cell phone number or something, that would be, how would that be different from a 911 call?
So it goes to prong two of the five-factor analysis, whether the informant can be held responsible if the allegations are untrue. So possibly if they direct dial the officer's phone number, they happen to know them, then the officer could call them back. But it's not clear that that was the case here. It's not a prong that they dispute at all in their brief. So the only prong they dispute is prong four, possibly prong three, but they don't dispute this one. But even if they did, there's just no record evidence to support that they had any way of following up with this individual or hold them accountable.
Okay.
All right, counsel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The court thanks counsel for their patience to get to you this morning and for your helpful arguments. The court will take the matter under review.